Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 3rd of June, these are our main stories. The family of George Floyd are accompanying tens of thousands of people on a march through his hometown of Houston. President Trump is facing growing criticism for his handling of the protests, many of which have descended into violence and looting. Also in this podcast, scientists say the blood of someone with coronavirus could provide clues as to how ill they're likely to become. And as lockdown restrictions across Europe are eased, people in France are now able to visit bars and cafes.
It was the thing I missed the most during the lockdown, to be able to come and sit whenever I wanted to have a drink in a cafe.
We begin this podcast in George Floyd's hometown of Houston in the US state of Texas. There, tens of thousands of people have been marching solemnly and peacefully to the steps of City Hall in his memory. Members of his family are there, including Roxy Washington, the mother of his six-year-old daughter.
I'm here for George because I want justice for him. I want justice for him because he was good. No matter what anybody thinks, he was good. And this is the proof that he was a good man.
During the last 7 nights, many of the protests across the US have descended into violence and looting, prompting President Trump to say he'll send in the military. And his tweets today have continued in a similar vein. The president's Democratic rival for the White House, Joe Biden, called George Floyd's death a wake-up call for the nation and accused Donald Trump of being more interested in power than principle.
A country is crying out for leadership. Leadership that can unite us. Leadership that brings us together. Leadership that can recognize pain and deep grief of communities that have had a knee on their neck for a long time.
President Trump is facing growing criticism for his handling of the protests, as I heard from our correspondent in Washington, Aleem Makbul.
Widely criticised in some quarters, of course, there are a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump because they wanted him to get tough on things just like this. A lot of people very upset after Ferguson, I remember, telling me in 2016, was a large part of the reason they wanted a law and order president, and that's why they say they voted for Donald Trump. But while Donald Trump keeps talking about how he cracked down on looters and rioters, we were right here on this spot yesterday and witnessed, before the curfew, on the orders of Donald Trump, security forces here firing tear gas and rubber bullets at peaceful, legal protesters as well. And that is what he's being criticized for from certainly critics in the Democratic Party, but many others as well.
Aleem, we can hear a lot going on behind you. What are you seeing? Where are you?
Well, there are hundreds of people here once again outside the White House. There have been new barricades put up, though, so they can't get as close as they could over the last couple of days, these protesters. But what we've also seen in Washington in the last hour or so is military personnel fanning out across the city. And Donald Trump and the Department of Defense have promised that hundreds more National Guardsmen and women will be present on the streets. That's when there's already been criticism that the streets have been too saturated with security personnel over the last couple of nights. But what we are also seeing is new pockets of protest, new congregations of protesters in Washington in places they haven't protested over the last couple of days, presumably trying to sidestep those security forces.
It's now more than a week since George Floyd's murder. From what you're saying, it doesn't sound as though things are going to die down anytime soon.
In some ways, clearly, over the last couple of days, a lot of the chaos that we saw over the weekend has subsided to some extent here in Washington, but we are seeing other hotspots. New York City had a lot of looting during the night. But in terms of the protests themselves, if anything, a president who is coming down hard on legal, peaceful protests is giving people another reason to come out. A lot of people here today have said this is the first time they're coming out, because they're now not just angry about the killing of George Floyd and of the historic injustices that black people have faced here. They're now also protesting against the president's actions over the last few days. So he can keep coming down hard with all these security forces, but that, of course, is not sustainable over a long period of time. And meanwhile, this anger is, as you say, continuing.
Ali McBool. The Black Lives Matter movement, which is at the heart of these protests, was created in response to the acquittal of a white man for the fatal shooting of Trayvon Martin, an unarmed African-American teenager, in 2012. The group's co-founder, Patrice Cullors, has been speaking to the BBC, giving her reaction to President Trump's earlier threat that he'd call in the military to deal with the unrest.
The president's remarks to a community of people who are grieving, who are angry, and who are hurt were deeply irresponsible and very dangerous. What we need right now in this country is leadership that is willing to ask the hard questions about how we got here. And as they ask those hard questions, willing to go to the community and say, what do you need? How can we support you? How can we take care of you? We know we've neglected you for hundreds of years. We know that this is a result not just of George Floyd's death, but from economic disenfranchisement, from decades-long Jim Crow and mass incarceration, from police violence and police terror. We need leaders who are willing to own up to their mistakes and then to ask questions about how they can fix those mistakes.
Patrice Cullors, one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement. Well, Elizabeth Harrington is the national spokesperson for the Republican Party and has been defending the president's proposals.
Well, I think first and foremost, we need to take a stand against lawlessness. And both of these conversations are about ending lawlessness. What happened to George Floyd was not law and order. That was not due process. It's an outrage. But it's also an outrage to have minority-owned businesses burnt to the ground, to have people throwing bricks, to have people looting en masse, lighting churches on fire. That is lawlessness. So we need to restore law and order and have justice in this country. That's what I think is the unifying line, because just listen to the Floyd family. They're now crying out and saying, this is not what we should be doing in response. We should not allow outside groups to infiltrate and cause these riots that are just completely and utterly lawless.
Elizabeth Harrington from the U.S. Republican Party. The violence in the U.S. has prompted international concern. A senior United Nations official said George Floyd's death was an example of entrenched racial discrimination. The EU has called for a calming of tensions. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Caroline Hawley.
The death of George Floyd, the video of him gasping for breath, begging for help, caused revulsion around the world. Now disquiet is growing about the U.S. government's response to the protests that the killing has sparked. The EU today said it was shocked and appalled by Mr. Floyd's death. Its chief diplomat, Josep Borrell, also said that a proper investigation was needed.
This is an abuse of power, and this has to be denounced in the States and everywhere. And I think that all societies must remain vigilant against the excess of use of force.
Here, a spokesman for Boris Johnson said any decision on sending in the army was an internal matter, but he called for peaceful protests to be allowed and described the scenes from the US as very alarming. And the UN has now expressed concern about the entrenched inequality that's fueling the unrest. Its most senior human rights official, Michelle Bachelet, spoke of endemic racial discrimination, inequalities in education, employment, and, of critical importance now, health. Coronavirus has taken a heavy toll on African Americans, and Michelle Bachelet called for urgent steps to address the disproportionate impact it's having, not only in the United States, but around the world.
Caroline Hawley. And later in this podcast, we'll hear the reaction and thoughts of the Oscar-winning American filmmaker Spike Lee. At the moment, there's general global understanding that if you're elderly or have some pre-existing health conditions, you should shield yourself to avoid contracting COVID-19. But we know that even within these groups, those infected can respond very differently. Some may have no symptoms, some need to be hospitalised, and for others the disease is fatal. Now, scientists at the Francis Crick Institute in London and Charité Université Médecine in Berlin say the blood of someone with coronavirus could provide clues as to how ill they're likely to become. Professor Marcus Rauser is the lead author of the study and told my colleague Pascal Harter about the findings.
Essentially, what we work on are modern versions of blood tests, where at one point in time we quantify thousands of individual molecules, thousands of proteins, and they give us a picture about how this patient is in this particular moment in time. And we applied these techniques now to early cohorts of COVID-19 patients, and we could see that these blood signatures distinguish patients which have severe forms, critical forms, or even milder forms of the disease. And so we hope that these develop into prognostic tests that we can make available or can be made available to the clinicians and help them to decide, you know, who needs an intensive treatment, who needs probably other forms of treatment. And in this way, we hope to support them to direct the right therapy to the right patient.
And how firm is that hope? I mean, does this sound to you like the key which would help us to unlock lockdown?
Well, this is not that quick. No? So these are now early results. This is a new disease that we know about since a couple of months. Everyone speeds everything up at the moment as fast as we can. But realistically speaking, such tests might become available in a second or a third wave of the disease. They wouldn't be available tomorrow morning.
So when do you think then? Next spring, perhaps?
Next spring is an optimistic schedule, and it's doable for rolling it out to some selected clinics, which are research clinics. And then if this goes well, then probably mid next year, those could be tests that could be available in a much broader sense.
And did your research offer any clues as to what is it that makes certain people react so badly to the virus?
Well, it adds to a lot of investigations that are going on at the moment. And basically, long story short, is that the individual's immune system, of course, responds differently in different individuals and fights, therefore, the virus more or less effectively. And that's, in the end of the day, what we also see reflected in these blood tests that we run.
So what are you going to do next?
Yeah, so now it's time to validate this. This was a first group of patients, and we are very optimistic, but of course this is not validated. So we now go to other clinics, to other patients. We try to see, do the results hold? Are they robust? And if it's the case, then in the next phase, you would start to develop routine assays that ordinary hospitals can then provide for the patients.
And just very briefly, because we're running out of time, in a few words, if you would, how encouraged are you by the scientific effort that's been made globally to combat COVID-19?
Extremely. I haven't seen something like this in my lifetime. Now, everyone who can contribute to the problem has put all their efforts, all their resources in. People are collaborative, working together. And if there is any positive outcome of this crisis, is that the scientific world has come together and tries in combined force to help us through this time.
Researcher Professor Marcus Rauser. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Still to come, how one of India's biggest employers, the tea industry, has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic. And we'll hear from the Oscar-winning filmmaker Spike Lee on those protests across the US.
Racism is all over the world. And so this is a global pandemic before Corona.
Brazil is suffering from the pandemic more than anywhere else in Latin America. And within the country, the hardest hit of all is perhaps its indigenous community. One of the most isolated tribes, the Yanomami, at least has now launched a petition demanding the government remove illegal gold miners from the Amazon region where they pose a particular threat. Our America's editor, Candace Peart, told me more about how the virus was reaching them.
Well, it's a huge territory and you can only cover it either by aeroplane or by boat. And most people tend to travel by riverboat and you stay on these journeys for days and days up and down the rivers, sleeping very close together in the hammocks. And you're Basically, it's people taking the viruses from crowded towns to other areas, rural areas. And indigenous people have families and friends in towns, and members come and go between the cities and their villages in the forest. So, so there's an issue there about contagion. But of more concern is the illegal activity of Brazilians in the forest, gold miners who are making their journeys deep into the rainforest, but then they spend their rest time in the towns and cities, taking the virus to and fro with them.
And it's that mixing with the indigenous people, with the Yanomami, that is causing the problem.
Yeah, the first cases of amongst the Yanomami, there's been about five cases around that, were students going home, taking the virus from the towns back to their villages. Now, the Yanomami have very little or less resistance to diseases, partly because they live communally and share everything, and also because they're poor people and they're weakened by that as well. But also it's not going to help that the miners have invaded their territories, and so they don't have any protection. Now, they're asking the government to increase the monitoring of their reserves and the policing. This is illegal activity. Indigenous people by the constitution are allowed to have their reserves free of other Brazilians. But the trouble is, this government has advocated that mining in indigenous areas is okay, not advocated, but suggested or turned a blind eye to, and has also spoken of a plan to open up the region to industry, mining and agriculture, which has emboldened the miners invading indigenous reservations.
Our America's editor, Candace Peart. Coronavirus restrictions have continued to be relaxed in Europe today. Gyms and bars have been allowed to reopen in several towns and cities in Germany, despite concerns that the lockdown is being lifted too quickly there. France has removed most of its controls, allowing bars and cafes to open, along with museums and beaches. But stricter measures are still in place in Paris, where the risk of infection is higher than elsewhere in the country. Our correspondent Lucy Williamson has joined Parisians in enjoying a visit to a cafe.
The sight of chairs and tables stacked in darkened cafe windows was a sign of France's social and economic coma. Today, for the first time in more than 2 months, there are people sipping coffee in the sunshine at my local cafe. There are new rules: a maximum of 10 people per table, 1 metre between tables, and no standing at the bar. Staff and anyone getting up to use the toilet will need to wear a mask. Here in Paris, it's only terraces that are allowed to open. The mayor has said that any establishment without one can use pavements or car parks. But with the virus still circulating here more widely than elsewhere, how safe do customers feel?
It's something strange to explain, but to share a coffee with someone else is a part of the Parisian way of living.
It was the thing I missed the most during the lockdown, to be able to come and sit whenever I wanted, to have a drink in a cafe.
A new mobile app, Stop COVID, will be available for download from today to help track and trace new infections. But the government has said it's pleased with how the virus has responded to the lifting of lockdown so far. After more than 28,000 deaths and months of fear and economic coma, France is slowly coming alive again.
Lucy Williamson in Paris. Let's go to India now. It has the fifth largest economy in the world, but its size hasn't protected it from the impact of the coronavirus and the lockdown that followed. Unemployment has gone up by 120 million since March. One of the country's biggest employers, the tea industry, has been badly affected. Divya Arya reports on the impact on the tea harvest and the outlook for the wider Indian economy.
Fine granules of tea roll down the machine as the Assam Tea Company's production plant comes back to life. The tea industry is shaking off 3 weeks of inaction. After completely closing operations under the countrywide lockdown, tea pickers are finally back in their fields.
We live in a tea garden. Where will we go if the job is gone?
Tea has been an integral part of Dohri Nagbanshi's working life. She has been picking leaves since the past 40 years, when she inherited the job from her sister. She says she has no other way to feed her family.
We have no other options. If we had our own land, we could do farming. If the tea garden work is gone, how will we eat?
India has a workforce of almost 500 million people, of which more than 1 million work in the tea industry. Here in Assam, they're wearing masks and standing with adequate gap amongst each other as they pick leaves. But social distancing rules in some states mean that not everyone is allowed to work. Vijay Singh is Dohri's employer and the CEO of Assam Company India Limited. After losing the first harvest, he has just managed to save the second. But now, as he counts his losses, he is worried about the future of the whole tea business.
We have suffered due to disruption in logistics, disruption in sampling, disruption in the warehouse closing. We could not transport our teas that we produced in the beginning of the season, which was locked up in the factories for 3 weeks. And this affected the cash flow. Even today, situation in Western India is limping back to normalcy.
Tea growers across the country have been affected, and government estimates suggest that the industry has lost at least $132 million so far. The impact could be global as well as felt acutely at small tea stalls across the country.
Millions of people here and around the world enjoy a cup of tea every day. But for some Indians who have lost their jobs and savings in the 2-month-long lockdown, even this cheap cup of tea may soon become unaffordable. As the entire Indian economy begins to slow down, it's not just the tea producers and pickers that are being affected, it's everyone.
The economic future for India is unpredictable. But some analysts think the Indian economy could shrink by nearly 4% this year. That's a loss of $110 billion, just over a quarter of the government's entire spending for the year. And the pressure is building. India is the world's fifth largest economy, but in the last 2 months, its already high unemployment level has tripled. Amongst its 1.3 billion people, those with the least will face the toughest challenges.
Divya Arya reporting from India. Motor racing officials have approved plans for the Formula One season to begin in Austria at the beginning of next month. An initial 8-race season, which is the minimum number required under current rules to crown a driver's champion, will feature Grand Prix over consecutive weekends at Silverstone in August. Our sports editor Dan Rowan is at the circuit and has sent this report.
It's one of the defining highlights of the British sporting calendar, and now for the first time in its illustrious history, Silverstone will host not one, but 2 Formula One World Championship races when the much-delayed season resumes this summer, initially with 8 Grand Prix in Europe. With 7 of the 10 teams based in the UK, the circuit's managing director, Stuart Pringle, said the news had come as a major relief to the sport here.
It's a huge help. It's not as good as if we were running a normal Grand Prix with all the fans, but it's a massive step in the right direction. Like every business, we're staring down the barrel of horrific losses this year, and this will reduce the depth of the hole that we're in. But it's still a fairly sizable hole, and it's a challenging time for us, no question.
Motorsport bosses have been given assurances by the government that teams will be granted an exemption from a 14-day self-isolation rule on entry to the UK. Races will be staged behind closed doors, and circuits have committed to creating a biosecure paddock with regular testing, strict limits on the numbers of personnel granted access, and teams travelling in segregated bubbles. After months of shutdown, sports re-emergence is gathering pace, and with a record equaling 7th World Championship in the British driver Lewis Hamilton's sights, this most unusual of sporting summers could still provide many memorable moments.
Dan Rowan at Silverstone. Let's return now to our main story. The continuing demonstrations across America after the killing of George Floyd by police. The American filmmaker Spike Lee, known for his eloquence on the issue of racial injustice, has released a short film as part of the protests. Lee intercuts footage of his 1989 film Do the Right Thing with that of the arrests of George Floyd and Eric Garner, both of which resulted in their deaths. He spoke to our arts editor, Will Gompertz, about the latest civil unrest.
People are fed up, not just black folks. Have you seen the footage of the protesters? It's very, very diverse. And but what's exciting for me, though, is that it's a generation of my young white sisters and brothers who don't want to do what their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, you know, and we go further back. You know, they see that that way is evil, is unjust. And so there's a solidarity here, which I haven't seen since I was a young kid. You know, I was 10 years old, 67. So that's when you saw Black Panther Party, the anti-war movement, people were getting together.
You think the George Floyd incident is a genuine turning point?
Well, I think that we have to, or we should, honor Mr. George Floyd. But it's not just him. You had my brother was jogging in Georgia, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor. Someone just got killed yesterday in Louisville, Kentucky, by the cops. This is not new. I mean, my ancestors were taken from Mother Africa and brought to Jamestown, Virginia. The first ship landed 1619. So I would like to say to you and your audience, this is not new.
And also we have situations where black people die in prison. We have a situation today when the whole music business has come out in solidarity for George Floyd. This is a situation that seems to have resonated beyond America.
Yes, and I think that's a good point. I'm glad you bring it up, because many times over my film career, when I go to film festivals or whatnot, and I get interviewed by journalists, you know, one of the first questions is always, you know, about whatever racial incident just happened in the United States of America. And United States of America, racism, they do it better than anybody else. But racism is all over the world. And so this is a global pandemic before Corona. I'm a very spiritual person. And I don't think that's coincidence that these two things are happening at the same time.
The thoughts of the Oscar-winning filmmaker Spike Lee. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.